Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome. Señoras y señores, boa tarde, bem-vindos a todos. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program here at CSIS. It's a pleasure to welcome you to this very important event in which we'll be discussing access to justice, lessons from the civil rights experiences in Brazil and the United States, a topic of great importance. This meeting is a follow-up. It's an important event sponsored by and promoted by the Joint Action Plan to Promote Racial and Ethnic Equality between the United States and Brazil. The U.S. and Brazil share many similarities, and one of the most important, there being democracies with a population that is multi-ethnic, multiracial, and the issues related to civil rights and to the access to equal treatment under law are key to both countries. So this event is very timely, very important. We're delighted to have with us today His Excellency Edson Santos, who is the Minister of the Special Secretariat for Policies to Promote Racial Equality in Brazil. Mr. Minister, it's a great pleasure to have you here, as well as all of our other distinguished guests on this panel. To also welcome the audience and to make introductory remarks, I'm very pleased to present His Excellency Antonio de Aguiar Patriota, the Ambassador of Brazil to the United States. Mr. Ambassador.
Well, good afternoon, boa tarde a todos. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this event today, which started, I thought, in a very, very productive way. We were very honored to have the Minister for the Promotion of Racial Equality, Ministro Edson Santos, here with us in Washington. And we were very happy also this morning to have had the Assistant Secretary for the Western Hemisphere, Ambassador Tom Shannon, as well as Congressman Gregory Meeks, addressing our group and in what I thought were two very interesting panels. This afternoon, let me thank CSIS for being part of this project, a very important project for Brazil and the United States at this stage of our relationship. And highlighting our experiences and the lessons learned from the civil rights experiences in Brazil and the United States. And I would be remiss if I didn't recognize not only Peter DeShazo's contribution, but also very warmly Joanna Mendelson-Forman here to my left, who has been an enthusiast of this discussion. We have a very distinguished panel with us, Mr. Wade Henderson, President of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, whom I met recently at Congress, Congresswoman Donna Edwards' office. And as was mentioned this morning, we're very pleased that a group of 17 U.S. congressmen and women have written a letter in support of the joint plan of action between Brazil and the United States to combat racial discrimination. This ensures what we are very pleased to see is a widening circle of support for our joint endeavors. We also have a representative from the NAACP, Elaine Jones, Jessica Ginsburg from the U.S. Department of Justice, and Fernanda do Vale Caribe Schuchel from the Ministry of Justice in Brazil, as well as a representative of the Center for Studies on Labor Relations and Inequalities, Antonio Carlos Malaquias. If I can just say a few words about the status of the Brazil U.S. relationship as the Obama administration completes 100 days. I think we were off to a very positive start when President Lula was received at the Oval Office in mid-March, and our two presidents discussed a ambitious and broadening bilateral agenda. Of course, the time is one of economic crisis, and this is the subject that has been attracting the most attention, whether it's in bilateral relationships or worldwide. But our interpretation of what we should be doing in times such as these of crisis are very similar, or the emphasis placed by both President Obama and President Lula in looking forward and looking at the most vulnerable segments of society, among them those who have been the victim of racial discrimination, was very present, whether it was in their commitment to work together to improve the livelihood of populations in developing countries, and their joint interest for Haiti, for example, a sister nation in the Caribbean, the first African-American republic, independent African-American republic in our hemisphere, through other mechanisms such as this. This is a mechanism that was created by Minister Edson Santos and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in Brazil in March of last year. But we believe that now that there's an African-American president at the White House, we will only have a further incentive to enhance our cooperation. And I must say that I'm very pleased by the attendance, the interest that it is generating, and we see great scope for different types of action that we may develop under this format. With these few brief remarks, let me just thank you all for being present here today. I just wanted to add very briefly that Minister Santos arrives in the United States after having headed our delegation to the Durban Review Conference in Geneva. And while this is a conference that is seen as controversial in some quarters, it's important to note that it is thanks to the process leading to the conference that Brazil started organizing itself in ways that it had never done previously to look at the issue of racial discrimination and racial equality. In fact, the very secretariat or ministry, which is headed by Minister Edson Santos here present, is an outcome of that process. It's a new position that was created in Brazil under President Lula, now 6 years of age, still in its infancy, but one that I think holds very important prospects for Brazil to become a true racial democracy. So with these few words, let me pass the floor to the speakers, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. It's my pleasure to introduce Ms. Jessica Ginsburg of the Department of Justice.
On behalf of the Department of Justice, I'm very pleased to welcome you also to this very important panel. I work in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and I've actually worked in civil rights enforcement for 20 years. I've spent basically my entire legal career doing civil rights enforcement for the U.S. government, mostly on the criminal side. I spent 16 years in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division enforcing the nation's civil rights laws. So I wanted to take a minute just to talk about the Civil Rights Division and the issues that we face today in terms of discrimination and violence based on race in the United States. The Civil Rights Division is one of the lead government entities that's charged with enforcing the nation's civil rights laws, and we do that both on the criminal and civil side. In civil litigation, we see problems in voting, and in fact, the Supreme Court today is hearing arguments in a very important voting case that could dramatically impact the role that the Civil Rights Division can have in voting litigation in the future. In the housing area, in terms of access to public accommodations, in employment, in education, and in related parts of civil society. These are all an attempt to make sure that all important areas of life are open to people regardless of race and free from discrimination. We're not the only part of the government that's responsible for this. We have a number of partners in different federal agencies that also have significant roles to play. One of the primary ones is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which ensures that victims who feel that they face discrimination in their jobs actually have a federal agency dedicated to hearing and investigating their complaints. I'm actually very pleased and honored that Stuart Ishimaru, the acting chair of the commission, is actually here today to participate in this dialogue. In the United States, of course, we've had a long history of problems, discrimination problems against African Americans and other minority racial groups that we are continually striving to address. And we've come a very long way, but it's still a struggle. I mean, one example that often many people look to about how far we've come was the election of President Obama in November of last year, the first African-American president in the United States. Well, that same we recently completed a prosecution of an event that occurred that night, the night of the election, when some white men in Staten Island, New York, were upset about the outcome of the election, and they went to African-American neighborhoods and attacked several African-American men because they believed they'd voted for Barack Obama. One of the men was beaten with a baton and actually run over with a car and was in a coma for several months. The Civil Rights Division, along with our partners in the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, investigated and prosecuted that case, and recently the last of the three defendants pled guilty to felony charges based on their role in that assault. That's just one example of the kind of overt hostility that still exists in the United States today. Just to give you one other example, just last week on April 20th, we got a guilty plea from a man in West Virginia who had set fire to his neighbor's house. His neighbor was a white woman, but she had black friends over to her house on occasion, black guests. And based on that relationship that this woman was trying to have in the privacy of her own home, her neighbor set fire to her house. So that is the kind of overt violence and discrimination that still occurs in this country and that we're constantly striving to address and overcome. We also have a lot of more subtle discrimination. You know, back in the 1960s, as I actually was a little too young to remember this, but some of you may remember in parts of the United States, there were, before the civil rights laws, the recent civil rights laws were enacted, there were signs saying whites only. And that was something that happened in the South, and some vestiges of that, you can still read it, see it in the history books. But now in the United States, we don't see those signs anymore, but we still see the same effect sometimes. And just to give you another case example, back in November, we successfully settled a housing discrimination case. There were no signs in that housing complex saying that they would not rent to African Americans, but in fact, that's what happened. And they refused to rent to African Americans. This was in Michigan. And complaints came in to the Department of Justice. One very interesting and important thing about that case, I think for purposes of this panel, is that we worked very closely with a fair housing, private, non-governmental fair housing group in Michigan to conduct what we call testing. This is an effort to determine if there's discrimination by sending in usually their department employees, but they're basically undercover officers for the day, posing as people who want to rent an apartment. And based on what they're told and the difference in treatment between white people and black people who are sent in, given very similar backgrounds, we can prove sometimes that discrimination happened. And that's what happened in that case. I think that case does highlight the great importance and value of civil society and NGOs in the United States. I can't tell you how honored I am to be on to be introducing this panel with such esteemed colleagues. In the United States, these organizations are very, very highly respected, both within the government and in society generally. And I think that's a very important factor in the success that we've had in moving forward. So in the future, I hope there's a continued role that I and the Civil Rights Division and the Justice Department can play in furthering the dialogue that we have. And I'll be available if anyone is interested in further case examples or discussions. And I'm very happy to discuss that with anyone who's interested. So thank you again for including me today.
Thank you very much. Our good friend Milt Drucker from the State Department will make some housekeeping announcements, and then we'll begin.
Just by way of reminder for everyone going back to State Department this afternoon, the buses outside will leave at 4:15. You're not obligated to take that bus if you'd like to stay here for the coffee. But for those people leaving, we have a bus at 4:15. We'll go back to the State Plaza Hotel. Tomorrow we begin promptly at 9 a.m., and your prompt attendance will be deeply appreciated. Thank you. Well, you'll remember this morning I mentioned that people had to return the badges or they'd be pursued. Well, two people haven't returned their badges, so they may find themselves pursued when they go out for dinner this evening. Please, I urge you, if you could return the badges, we'd appreciate it. Thank you. You can give them to LaDonna right here.
Thanks, Milton. It's my pleasure to introduce my colleague of the Americas program, Dr. Johanna Mendelson-Forman, who will chair this very interesting and distinguished panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Ambassador Patriota, and thank you, Ms. Ginsburg, for opening this event. It's an honor, of course, to be here with so many dedicated people who have spent their lives and careers in both countries trying to advance the civil rights of fellow citizens. And the timeliness of this panel, which has been touched on by everybody, just underscores how important our efforts are, not only in the United States, but in the Americas, to ensure that every citizen has access to the full protection of the laws. That's what I grew up as a lawyer learning, and I assume that all my colleagues on this panel have felt the same. I just wanted to recall one thing before we started, because a little over a month ago, the preeminent chronicler of race in the United States, John Hope Franklin, passed away at 94 years old. And the historian, who broke many barriers of his own, talked about one thing, and that was practicing patience. He was certainly a dedicated gardener and a very talented historian, but patience was something that he said was the secret to advancing the civil rights agenda, to creating good legal tools, to laws that would also use the excellent talents of colleagues that I have the honor to share this panel with, to ensure that we have a legacy of education, voting, and public life that allows people in our country to elect a president like Barack Obama. And that's one of the things that's important. But Franklin also recalled one thing, and he said that the color line was the most tragic and persistent social problem this country faced. And he would also be gratified to see that this legacy of his own studies and research expanded to other countries. So when the opportunity to bring Brazil and other countries of the Americas into this discussion, where we share many tragic reminders of a dreadful legacy, the event today actually offers us a lesson in history and also a way to look forward. On a personal note, I just want to thank everybody from the State Department to the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights to the Ministry in Brazil to my colleagues in both sides of the hemispheres for working together to ensure that we had a successful program. And I also just want to underscore that we had wonderful sponsorship from both the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and UNICA, the Sugarcane Industries Association, for support of a lunch that was made possible for the participants earlier today. Now, I'm not going to take up more time because we have a panel that is so rich with talent that I will step back and just say that with people like Minister Santos, whose biography you have, Mr. Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, Elaine Jones, who was the past president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and held many other roles in this our own long struggle for civil rights, Fernanda Caribe from Brazil, and Antonio Malaquias, we will go through this panel, and you will see that the breadth of experience and their own struggles to work for citizenship and access to justice are models we can follow in the future. So I will be quiet, which is not usually the case as a lawyer and Latin Americanist, and let my panelists share the podium. And I will be happy to facilitate not a question and answer, but a real dialogue among all of you who spent your afternoon today with us. So thank you. And we're going to start with Minister Santos. There are headphones for those of you who have not taken translation equipment. And just as a reminder, Channel 4 is English and Channel 5 is Portuguese. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's working now. It's working now. I pushed every button on the panel here, but I just didn't push the one that I should have. I speak slowly, but I'll speak a little slower because I don't have prepared remarks. So to make the life of the interpreters a bit easier, I'll be very cautious and careful as I address you, and also to communicate to you what my ideas are about this topic. First of all, I would like to talk about CEPIR. That's the Special Secretariat for the Promotion of Racial Equality Policies. And it's the result of a commitment taken by the Brazilian government when it ratified the Durban Agreement in 2001. And as a consequence of that agenda, the Brazilian government created this secretariat to fight racism and to promote racial equality in our country. Brazil is the second country in terms of black population in the whole world. We have 49.5% of the population, according to the last census, of Afro-Brazilians are blacks. This population has not been assisted by the state since slavery was abolished. There was no access to land ownership, education, or jobs for the former slaves. And that omission created a level of social inequality for black people, which prevails and persists until today. The Constitution of Brazil provides that as Brazil signs into international agreements, those international agreements are applicable and should be implemented in Brazil as well. And they must influence the public policies that are developed by the country. As far as a racial issue is concerned, the Durban Agenda is an important element in the development of public policies that have to do with reducing racial inequality in our country. I would like now to open a parenthesis and to say to you that I was very honored when I led the Brazilian delegation to the revision conference in Geneva. The Durban Agenda could not and should not be reduced to a regional conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And luckily, 99.99% of the time used in Durban were devoted to discussing racial equality, the fight against intolerance, the fear of foreigners, and that allowed for us in Geneva to also move forward in terms of increasing rights that were already part of the conference in 2001. I'm talking about religious freedoms. And there are provisions now that open the way to dealing with legal issues related to sexual orientation, which, of course, broadens the rights that were that originated, if you will, in the 2001 conference. And the document that was issued in Durban has no aggressive statement vis-a-vis any country in the world. So those who were not in Durban, and when they see this document, they will be at ease in taking in this document, because this document talks about racism, intolerance, xenophobia, and intolerance among men and women. And therefore, reducing that Durban agenda to a regional conflict would really avoid issues that are very important for Africa, issues that touch half of the Brazilian population and which also touch an important part of the U.S. population and millions of immigrants that live in Europe now. So I don't think it would be right to reduce that important topic to that conflict. As I said, Brazil signed this agreement. Now, being a signatory is one thing, and translating that into commitment of the country or the government in terms of public policies to implement it, I mean, there's a distance there. I mean, signing an agreement is not enough. It's also necessary to take in the directives of the document in question and translate all that in public policies that will improve the quality of life of the population of the country. And this is the challenge that we are confronted with now. And our Constitution, of course, provides for many rights for the population, but it's essential that such principles that are enshrined in the Constitution and in the laws of the country be known by the public and be implemented broadly and deeply by all sectors of the population. And the challenge, the big challenge that we're confronted with today in Brazil is exactly that, to take the laws and the rights through public policies to those who need these rights. So the Constitution, of course, mandates the state, the government, to provide for the citizens policies that are favorable to consolidating citizenship and also protect vulnerable sectors of the society. Such is the challenge that we are facing now as we talk about access to justice, access to rights. The population must need the laws that protect them, the laws that are beneficial to them. And if the government is insensitive to those principles, it becomes up to the public to be aware of the laws, to be aware of their rights, and to demand the implementation of such principles by the government. And promotion of racial equality and the fight against racism in Brazil differs very much from the U.S. experience. Here in the U.S., segregation existed here. Our colleague from the Justice Department, for instance, the Civil Rights Division, explained to us certain things that happened here and that marked the history of the United States, but also that brought to the fore the racial issue here in the United States. In Brazil, the racial issues are not that visible. There's no such transparency about racial issues in Brazil as they were here throughout U.S. history. In Brazil, for instance, nobody says, well, nobody will ever put a panel somewhere saying, well, you can't, blacks cannot go into this bus, you cannot go to college, you cannot own a business. No, there are no laws that prevent any citizen from having access to all of the above. However, the government, on the other hand, throughout our history, does not extend opportunities to the citizenry so that citizens can develop their full potential and thus playing the best role for that person as a human being within Brazilian society. Nothing is forbidden in Brazil, but the difficulty is in terms of access. I mean, the possibility of accessing. We don't forbid anybody to get to the third floor, but there are no stairs leading to the third floor. That's an image of an image that describes the situation as it is in Brazil. So the situation, of course, is a barrier for the actions of those who fight against racism, to the democratic people who will want to press the Brazilian government in order to, for the government to, you know, fight itself against racial discrimination. And while the civil movement era was happening here in Brazil, Brazil considered itself a total racial democracy. It was thought that Brazil had solved through the generations all the racial problems. But all this misconception, of course, created difficulties now for promoting racial equality and for fighting against racism. For instance, I'd like to give you an example of what I'm saying. Our Constitution, of course, recognizes that there is racism, that there is inequality, and there is a principle enshrined in the Constitution that criminalizes racism, qualifies racism as a crime. So since 1988, racism is a crime, it's a felony in our country. And therefore, the Penal Code in Brazil provides for punishment against racism acts in Brazil. Somebody already asked me how many racist cases were punished. Up to 100,000? No. I said no, not 100,000, not 10,000, not even 1,000 of these cases were punished, because it's still very difficult to qualify a certain act as a racist act. First, because the population ignores the laws. Second, because the structures of the state are not really well tooled to deal with this issue. And that's when I think that this cooperation between the U.S. and Brazil could produce very good results for us. The U.S. experience to make racism visible to all, the way we treat here in the United States racial crimes, and also the training of public servants who will deal with these issues. In Brazil, nowadays, it's still difficult to... we don't have that many qualified government employees that could respond and help the victims against the racist acts that they're victims of. So if we're talking about access to justice, and we have our friend here, Fernanda do Valle, and she works for the Justice Ministry. So I think that in this area, a cooperation between us would be very good. Brazil wants to cooperate with the United States in terms of access to justice here. This would be a very positive development for the Brazilian government and the Brazilian people. So I think the American experience in this area could teach us a lot. If you talk about cooperation, for instance, cooperation is a two-way street. And in this case, I mean, one of the U.S. way will help us a lot with the U.S. experience, the historic experience that the U.S. government has accumulated in facing this issue. Nobody told me how long I had to speak, but I think I'm touching the end here of my time. So I would like to close. I would like to close so that we can listen to the others. I apologize because I didn't know how much time I had, and I continue to talk. So I would stop here, and then we'll have questions and answers to clarify. Thank you.
Al contrario, ministro. Stavo molto bom.
What you said was very good, Mr. Minister.
I'm going to turn the floor over to Mr. Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. If you want to use the podium, that's fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Johanna. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon to Ambassador Patriota, Minister Santos, the distinguished ladies and gentlemen of our panel this afternoon, and to this most distinguished audience, I bid you greetings. Good afternoon on behalf of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. I'm Wade Henderson. I'm the president of the Leadership Conference, which I'll explain in just a moment to those of you not familiar with our work. I'm also the Joseph Rao Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. And it's a special privilege to be here today to participate in this most important program. The Leadership Conference on Civil Rights is this country's premier civil and human rights coalition. We are a non-governmental organization founded in 1950 by 35 organizations and three distinguished leaders of the national civil and human rights movement. We were founded by A. Philip Randolph, who was the founder and president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the first African-American, African-descendant labor union here in the United States. Roy Wilkins, who was then the head of the NAACP, the nation's premier civil rights organization, the oldest civil rights organization in the country, and Arnold Aronson, a leader of the National Jewish Community Relations Advisory Council. These three individuals and 35 organizations came together in 1950 to foment social change using advocacy in the streets, litigation in the federal courts, and work with Congress to enact new laws that would extend the protection of the Constitution to all citizens of the United States, regardless of color, religion, national origin, etc. We have been involved in the passage or development of every major civil rights law in this country since the first modern civil rights statute of 1957. And today, the Leadership Conference consists of 200 national organizations that work together in coalition to advance and protect civil and human rights. One lesson that we learn from the work of the Leadership Conference is that if you are not working in coalition, you are not practicing the politics of effective social change. That no one organization, no one constituency has sufficient power unto itself to achieve a broad social agenda unless it is working in coalition with individuals and organizations that share a broader perspective for social justice in the country. That's who the Leadership Conference is, and I'm privileged to be its president. Now, it is especially fitting that this panel discussion would occur today, April 29th, 2009. It, of course, is the 100th day of the presidency of Barack Obama, and in this country, the 100-day time frame is considered a time for evaluation of the early period of a particular presidency. So it's an historic marker for evaluating the success in the early days of a new administration. And today is also the day that the United States Supreme Court, our highest court in the land, considered arguments in a case involving the constitutionality of arguably our most important civil rights statute, which is the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So it is especially fitting that this conversation would be held today. Secondly, this conversation occurs, of course, in the wake of the election of President Barack Obama, the first African-American president in the United States history. And there is much symbolism as well as substance in this note and fact. Obviously, the United States, as is Brazil, struggling to overcome and accommodate its legacy of involvement in the Western slave trade and the crime of slavery, the human rights crime, that affected both of our countries. And yet each country has made great progress in laying a foundation for representative democracy in the best sense of that term. For the United States to have elected an African American as its president, first time in our history, is of course very significant. But the election of 2008 was more than the election of Barack Obama, as important as that was. Because this was a campaign that saw the first woman in United States history, a senator, Senator Hillary Clinton, serve as a viable candidate for her party's political nomination, first time in the history of this country. It was also the first time that a Latin American, that a Latino citizen, a Hispanic American, ran for his party's nomination to the presidency. I'm referring now to Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico. First time that a Latino candidate was a credible candidate for his party's nomination. First time. It was also one of the first times in our history where a young white southerner, a southerner in the United States, signifies someone who is part of the country that seceded from the Union in 1860 to lay the foundation for our own Civil War. We had a white southerner who ran for his party's nomination, and he used the issue of poverty and the need to lift everyone out of poverty as his central theme. First time in 40 years that we've had a candidate like that. So we had an African American, a woman, a Latino, a white southerner, all whom competed for their party's nomination. Any one of them could have won. And the significance of that election, as well as the significance of Barack Obama's election, is not that we have a first African American president, as important as that is. It is a testament to the power, the transformative power, of the civil and human rights movement in the United States. The civil and human rights movement in the United States was the single most transformative movement of the 20th century. You saw a despised population move from being an outsider within the political system to 100 years later electing its first African-American president. That speaks to a level of power that is profound. I should note to you that the election of Barack Obama and his taking the presidency was just 100 years after the founding of the NAACP, this country's most prominent civil rights organization, founded on February 12, 1909. And by the way, that date was the 100th anniversary of the birthday of President Abraham Lincoln, one of our greatest presidents, whose tenure in office symbolized the civil war in this country and freeing of African American slaves. So there was great symbolism in choosing that date as the founding date for the NAACP. 100 years later, we have our first African American president. On the night that President Obama accepted the nomination of the Democratic Party, August 28, 2008, just last summer, that was 45 years to the day that Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of our Lincoln Memorial. 45 years to the day. The symbolism of these moments in time should not be lost on this conversation, because what it says is that through organized effort, through extraordinary persistence through a commitment to a social goal that everyone, regardless of color or regardless of birth, so long as you are working under a democratic system with a constitution that in theory applies to all, that transformative change is possible. Transformative change is possible. Now, have we achieved full equality in American life through the election of Barack Obama? Well, I almost raise that as a rhetorical question, because on its face, there's an absurdity to it. One can look at the conditions of the African descendant population of this country. One can look at the current status of the Latino population or the Native American indigenous Indian population of our country, American Indian population, and the disparities in circumstance of birth and quality of life are profound. By the way, let me recognize Principal Chief Chad Smith of the Cherokee Nation. Chad is a good friend, and I happen to see him here in the audience. Chad, it's good to see you. So honored to have you here. Chad is the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation based in Oklahoma, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And the history of the Cherokee Nation in this country speaks volumes of the experience of our indigenous population and lays a foundation similar and comparable to the experience of African Americans and the descendant populations in Brazil. So we know of what we speak. On its face, I would say to you that's an absurd statement. But there are lessons to be learned, and there are benefits to be achieved, even as we struggle to accomplish the results of full equality. Now, I want to give you one example of what I mean. Because we believe, and I'm going to discuss this in a bit more detail and then wrap it up. I know I'm encroaching on time. We believe that education, that is, access to quality public education for all students, is the single most important civil rights goal that we can achieve, comparable to the full participation in civil society by the right to vote. So the right to vote and the right to a quality education are the twin pillars of social advancement in our country, the twin pillars of social advancement. And yet, if I were to go anywhere in this country, I could show you graphic examples of inequality based on race. If I were to take you to Baltimore City, just next door to Washington, D.C., and compare the school system of Baltimore City, which is a predominantly black school system, with the school system of Baltimore County, which is its next door neighbor, a majority white school system, you would see a virtual contrast between resources, the quality of teachers available to students, advanced placement courses in math and science, the quality of the schools they attend, and you could make certain predictions of academic performance based on the physical surroundings in which students experience their education. I could do the same right here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. The contradiction between offering a public education in the capital city of the world's greatest representative democracy and yet still seeing rampant inequality based on race tells you that we have not done all that is necessary to achieve equality. And I can point that out in greater detail after the panel if you would like. So I'm going to make five observations about change, and then I'm going to conclude. Let me say to you that it is somewhat presumptuous of those of us here from the United States to lecture or to offer advice to those of you in Brazil struggling to achieve the same level of equality that we hope to accomplish for one another. It is somewhat presumptuous because the United States has not advanced as far as it would like many to believe, simply because we have the election of an African-American president. But because you have been gracious enough to invite us to participate in a comparative analysis of change in the United States and change in Brazil, I'm going to offer a few recommendations humbly with the hope that you will take that for what it's worth in terms of your own struggle for full justice and equality. There are, in my view, five elements to the campaign for social change, including access to justice, that is the subject of today's panel. There are five elements. The first element is to have a compelling case for equality, a real incentive case to be made for why equality, as we understand it under the law, is necessary, and how that equality is denied presently to those who are citizens entitled to full equality under the Constitution of your country. In the case of African Americans, at the time the NAACP was founded, there were a series of race riots taking place in the early 1900s in the United States that pointed up the complete collapse of federal authority in protecting the rights of African Americans. Those race riots were so well documented in local history, but not nationally, that only when African-American activists began looking at the impact did they realize it was necessary for the non-governmental organizational community to take action. Leadership in this respect does not come from the top down. It comes from the bottom up. The government will never be the source of change of the status quo without an incentive coming from the people that they purport to govern. So there has to be some elevation of concern and a compelling case to be made at the ground level. Second, there has to be a recognition that coalition politics are an important component of your strategy. In the case of the NAACP, it was the African American community and the Jewish community that formed an alliance based on mutual experiences of exclusion and intolerance and hate crime activity directed at those communities. And over time, it was broadened to include organized labor and those other organizations that came into existence in the aftermath of World War II that had a real incentive to advance civil and human rights. Organizations like the Japanese American Citizens League, representing groups who had been wrongfully interned during World War II, American citizens of Japanese ancestry, or religious groups who had been persecuted previously and sought common alliance by coming into a coalition. So coalition politics is the second element. The third element is an affirmative strategy for change. Those who were, you know, the organizers of the civil and human rights movement of the 20th century did not do so in a casual way in which they sought to achieve change willy-nilly without real consideration of a strategy. They had leaders who helped to devise a strategy for change, and they focused on two issues. The two issues that they chose to focus on were education, access to education, and access to the right to vote. If you don't vote, you don't count. And if your system does not protect the right to vote, that has to be compelling reason number one for achieving social change. You must be able to vote in a democratic system, otherwise your voice will not be heard. And so you need an affirmative strategy. And that strategy was pursued in three elements: advocacy from the streets, organizing efforts, litigation, using the courts as a tool for change, and legislation. Securing the needed legislation under the federal system that would establish the protection of rights of individuals who were affected by those policies. So that is point three, an affirmative strategy for change. And in this instance, using advocacy, litigation, and legislation as its component parts. Fourth is aggressive oversight and pursuit of federal enforcement. The non-governmental organization and communities, broadly defined, are the groups that help shine a mirror on the practices of the state or government in which we live and the need for change. There is usually a contradiction that needs to be exposed. The contradiction is based first on what the Constitution says everyone is entitled to receive, and then what in fact happens in practice. The contradiction between what should be and what is the contradiction that allows you to expose the failure of the government to take action, and it requires producing reports. Now, without going through it, I have a series of reports that we have produced over time that give you an example of what I'm talking about. Justice on Trial is a report that focuses on inequality in our criminal justice system, including the problem of drug laws being misapplied, racial profiling in the way in which our laws are enforced, both at the state and federal level. This is a report that we produced. We have other reports that we have done quite recently. We set up a national commission on the enforcement of fair housing laws. It's called the National Commission on Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. It was co-chaired by Henry Cisneros and Jack Kemp. Both are former secretaries, cabinet-level secretaries, for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. One is a Democrat, one is a Republican. And the commission that we assembled had a bipartisan national flavor to it that produced a report making recommendations for strengthening the nation's fair housing laws. We have just done a similar report on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, which was, under our system of government for the last 50 years, the conscience of the nation. It produced reports that exposed the failure of both the federal government and the states to enforce laws. It was an independent body that was given power in its creation to subpoena witnesses, to hold hearings that helped expose problems in the enforcement of laws. We have now made a set of recommendations to transform that body into a new civil and human rights commission, consistent with responsibilities that go beyond its present mandate. And then lastly, just as an example, we have a report which was just submitted this past year to the Commission on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, a United Nations body that is designed to monitor and oversee the Covenant on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. My point in showing you this document is that international advocacy, participation in UN efforts, monitoring conventions, is an important part of a domestic agenda. I'm pleased to report that the Leadership Conference participated in the Durban process as well as the Durban review process because we recognize how important that is. So oversight is the fourth issue. And then the last point that I would make, the last point that I would leave you with, is that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. That is a saying that was created by an organization called the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization that's a member of the Leadership Conference and one that pursues the goal of protecting civil rights and civil liberties. This notion that eternal vigilance, the efforts on the part of advocates like yourselves to ensure that the government does the right thing by making certain that it lives up to its promises under the Constitution of the United States and Brazil, is the important lesson that I think we in the United States can share with you. So with that, I will end my formal remarks. I thank you for your patience. I look forward to your questions, and thank you so much for participating today.
Thank you, Wade Henderson, for such an all-encompassing overview of the history of civil rights. I'd like to turn the floor over to Elaine Jones now, former president of the NAACP. Her bio is in the handout. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. I don't usually need a microphone, but I'll try not to blast you out of here. My remarks are going to be very brief. My name is Elaine Jones. I am a lawyer by training. I have spent more than 30 years litigating civil rights cases in the courts. I was head of an organization which is referred to as the premier civil rights legal organization in the United States, that came into existence in 1940. And the one who started our organization became the first African American on the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice Thurgood Marshall. I became head of the organization in 1993. I served as head of the organization until 2004, but prior to 1993, I was with the organization for 23 years. Now, the organization is called the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, a national organization with lawyers across the country. And we are also a part of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. But we know what our focus is. You know, you have to be clear as to what you do. Can't do everything. But whatever you choose to do, you must do well. And so LDF, as our organization is known, is credited for devising the legal strategy with the NAACP of ridding this country of apartheid American style. Now, from a 30-year perspective, here's my view. Wade is right when he talks about a representative democracy and the importance of education, quality education, and the right to vote. If a people does not have free and unfettered access to the ballot and is able to elect representatives of their choice, you do not have freedom. Now, for 222 years, since this country was founded in 1787, when we received our Constitution, until today, as I speak to you now, the right of minority citizens in America to vote continues to be under assault. Continues as I sit here. Now, the election of President Obama is a good thing. But what it is a milestone. It is not the end of the road. And as I sit here, there are forces in this country that are undercutting the very vote that it took to elect President Obama. The most central civil rights legislation we have had is the Voting Rights Act of 1965, when Martin Luther King and all of those African Americans and others, white Americans and others, walked across that Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. And we got that march across the bridge was in March of 1965. In August 1965, we got the Voting Rights Act. That act is what has given us the legal protection. And the politics and law go hand in hand. You cannot have one effective one without the other being effective. You cannot let the courts go off and do what they will, regardless of the views of the people. This morning, the Supreme Court of the United States considered a section of the Voting Rights Act which covers all of 9 states of this country where most of African Americans live. 9 states and parts of several other states, at least 4 other states. What is required is that if any state that is covered by this provision seeks to make a change in its law, it cannot do so unless it goes to the Department of Justice or the federal court to have this matter looked at. Pre-cleared, we call it. In other words, we do not have to bring a lawsuit every time one of these jurisdictions does something discriminatory. The government under this statute has an obligation to monitor what these troublesome areas do. It saves us time, it saves us money, and it lets us know in advance what these jurisdictions are doing. This is the provision that is now under assault and that the Supreme Court is deciding whether or not this is too much authority for the federal government. Today, that was argued. We have had that provision since 1965. On March 9th, the Supreme Court decided a case that has to do with how lines are drawn to determine what our districts look like when people are able to vote. In other words, how you draw the political subdivisions which determine the influence and your ability to elect people of your choice. And the court ruled against us on March 9th, 2009. So all I'm saying is the efforts are important. The coalitions, the organizations, the division of labor, the education, the focus, the discipline. All of that is important. But what is critical and important to remember, no matter how far you advance, you must keep in mind that everything you have gained, there are always those who want to take it back. And so the struggle is ongoing and it is continuous. And in a representative democracy, you have tools that you can use. And you have to use those tools. But one thing I have learned, one can never rest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jones, for that excellent set of comments. I'm going to turn the floor over next to Fernando do Caribe, who is from the Brazilian Ministry of Justice. Once again, if you are using the headphones, 4 is English, 5 is Portuguese. Thank you.
Bom. Talvez para a tristeza de alguns, eu não sou Fernanda do Caribe, eu sou Fernanda Caribé, assim como o pintor, só que o pintor é pseudônimo, então pra, o pintor já foi citado hoje de manhã, mas ele não faz parte da minha família, ele apenas usa o nome para divulgar.
Unfortunately, my name is not pronounced correctly. I'm Fernanda Caribé. Caribé is the name of a very famous painter from the state of Bahia. Thank you very much for this opportunity to be here. I'm honored to participate in this panel with so many eminent American officials. We are responsible today to put this kind of action into action. It has to be implemented. I will not be as emotional as the lady was, but this is a very important moment for the Brazilian government. Since our first meeting in Brazil, the Justice Ministry was present with representative of this PRONASI, which is the National Program for Public Safety with Citizenship and the Secretariat for Safety. The program was launched in 2007 to reduce criminality in the most violent cities in the country. These are cities where 29 people over 100,000 inhabitants died yearly. Our focus group are youth between the 15 and 20 years of age. We started a project of international technical cooperation for our public safety workers in order not to insist on bias and prejudices that were traditional in the country. This all can be experienced and be enriched through an exchange of information with our American partners. Unfortunately, we will not be able to reduce crime and violence if these public safety workers are not duly trained regarding racial discrimination as well, because we have about 440,000 people in our jails, and a vast majority of this population is either black or of black origin. These people discriminate against themselves without realizing it even. We have some training in public safety done through the National Secretariat for Public Safety, especially in terms of community police. The police person is recognized by his or her community. These are people who are trusted by their community, and then we are able to reduce the index of criminality in these communities. I'm the opposite of Minister Santos. I talk too fast. In terms of this plan of action, the Justice Ministry, through PRONASI, has elaborated a preliminary project or a draft project, which entails an exchange of knowledge and best practices between Brazil and the U.S. to overcome racial prejudice and move forward. The objective of this project is to contribute to the development of a permanent project in Brazil in order to instruct the training of these people. And we don't want to limit ourselves to human rights. When policemen are trained, they take certain courses, and there is a syllabus which includes guidelines that schools have to follow with all the topics involved. Our proposal is to include racial topic as one of the topics so that future policemen realize how important it is to avoid discrimination of a certain part of the population. Today, we have focal points within other topics or disciplines. Therefore, we don't have the necessary approach to the issue. The idea is to have three workshops, international workshops in Brazil, with the participation of at least five participants from the U.S. who were or are or have been police with experience with racial prejudice in the United States. As a result of that, it is our intention to issue a document to be incorporated into the syllabus of our police training courses and thus multiply this training so that they are aware of their actions and how they perceive reality, how they see themselves, and how they're supposed to act with their peers and be ready to function as policemen. We need the support and participation of civil society, represented by many here, so that we may implement this plan and in the near future consolidate other more daring projects and necessary to implement the plan. These policemen who work in Brazil today that understand the profile of the young criminal as somebody who lives in the slums, young, wears a cap, likes hip-hop, is black. Therefore, the community is seen as a prospective criminal, community of criminals. So this is the change that we are proposing through PRONASCE and the implementation of this plan of action. It's not just a matter of justice, but it is a matter of culture, change in education, change in the community of security, and work of these public officials. Thank you very much.
That overview of what is happening in the ministry. Mr. Malak, yes, you're the last, but I know we're going to have more discussion, so please go ahead.
Bom, here I am again. Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be able to make two presentations to such illustrious audience. I am going to present to you a little bit of the history of CERT and what is the basic idea of CERT when it comes to justice. But before getting into the matter and explain to you how CERT looks at all these issues, I would like to use an image here that was said by somebody who spoke before me. It is required to have the price of freedom is that of eternal vigilance, and I would include justice to that. I think it's constant, eternal, nonstop vigilance. The CERT, CEERT, we know Brazil is a large country, a very diverse country, and even the black population in Brazil is very diverse itself. Therefore, our feeling is that any solutions have to take into account this diversity, regional diversity, the different, you know, histories for the different areas of the Brazilian territory, their values, their subjective values that are part of what we see as Brazil today. And all these factors, of course, will help mold the thinking of the population anywhere it lives, I mean, in at level government, social society, and private sector. So on the basis of this first analysis, we think that the number of claims against discrimination faces legal instances that are committed to it, but who do not have the technical wherewithal to give a good response to that. So there are three aspects of this lack of capacity. The first one was mentioned here. It's training. In other words, see if this issue is not part of the initial training of lawyers and legal workers, I mean, it becomes very difficult to sensitize them for situations involving race. And, of course, the tendency of any the trends in any country like ours where there's racism is to deny. It's denial. Deny racism. Every time there is a complaint, you deny it. The same thing happens for women. We have an office for the rights of women, but when women bring suits there, the reaction is to deny it, to say no. But these people who receive these claims must understand really what's going on. Well, another factor in this equation is the following. Subjectivity, of course, and then, of course, gaps in legal training in Brazil, and also a lack of doctrine and jurisprudence related to discrimination, and also a tendency to generalize or ignorance of the law, which is very general and creates difficulty for the action of legal workers. So on the basis of these three issues, CERT has chosen a way to act. And what we do doesn't mean that what we have chosen is the only possible way to follow. And one of the choices that we've made in terms of what we can do are the following. CERT, I am trying to reduce the text that I have to give more time to questions and answers. At the CERT, we're now creating a specialized hot site on the web that will be launched in the month of July, and it's based on a research that dealt with legislation, doctrine, and jurisprudence. And this research has already surveyed more than 1,100 national, international court decisions that deal with racial issues. And we want to make all this analysis available to anyone on the internet. Another research that we've been carrying out deals with discrimination during trial by jury. This is also will be launched in July. So theoretically, the problem resides in the constitutional rights of fair and quick justice and the use of juries. So we use psychology, sociology to carry out this analysis because we know that it's very important to take into account the awareness of those who work in this sector. I'm not a lawyer or a legal worker. I studied geography, and I'm a teacher. And what we present to you here is the result of our relationship with the population at large. And that's why it's important for us to take into account different ideas when we're talking about the law and the administration of justice. So our research is more theoretical, more based in sociology, and at the same time a field work, which is more empirical and consisted in taking samples of trials that have been filed in the Court of Justice of Sao Paulo in the last 5 years, and we studied the following variables in all these suits. First, the skin color of the defendant. Is it white, not white, yellow? So the skin color of the defendant. As you know very well, in Brazil, this classification is by skin color and not origin, not ethnic origin. And of course, we are studying the same number of trials or court cases with whites and non-whites. Then it's a criminal record of the defendant, trying to look for uniformity in terms of these records between white and not white defendants, and the type of defense. We, in this case, choose cases where the defendants were counseled by public defenders or volunteer defenders. Number four, the voting. The voting by the jury, the judges, you know, the yes votes, the no votes, and the verdict. Point five is the length of the sentence, the initial regimen, and then how long did the trial take. in, for blacks and whites, etc. So CERT uses this as a tool for diagnostic and for a tool, as a tool for acting also and promoting access to judicial system. One of the particularities of my organization is that of training. This morning we've talked about that, and we emphasize training because one of the laws in Brazil, the 2639, which makes the teaching of African and Afro-Brazilian teachings mandatory, has an advantage, and maybe the greatest advantage of this law in terms of relations, social relations in Brazil, is to give an opportunity to training people in general about race issues. When we carry out a debate like this one, or a discussion like this one, which may give birth to a certain polarity, because when we talk about these things in Brazil, it's always whites against blacks or whites against not whites. So these discussions are very much like that. And we try to, of course, take into account other racial relationships. So for us, the important thing to do to fight our fight is to emphasize training. So not only the initial training of all the workers, all the professionals, all those who make up the Brazilian institutions, be it private or public, but also, you know, and also recycling and training for life. Because there are aspects of ethnic racial relations that are not really mastered by the government or by universities or academic institutions. These relations, of course, are those created by 100 years of advocacy and fighting on this. And we have to take that into account when we are planning on actions against racism. In the last 8 years in Brazil, the federal government has shown a certain sensitivity to this issue. But we, the activists and who fight for civil society, and we have as an obligation, you know, these social aspects, we cannot be happy about the situation as it is now. No, we're not criticizing here the initiatives of the government, but the situation as it is now is very, very serious. It's part of the government's agenda, and it would should be the first topic for fighting against poverty and to promote the development of the country. It's essential for the development of Brazil that it looks honestly into their its own ethnic, racial relations. In Brazil, there are black organizations that in the last 20 years have organized exchanges with people from France, from the United States, and looked at the Brazilian reality, produced knowledge about the Brazilian society, and this knowledge now is beginning to be used by the government in its plans. And we're not criticizing any past government here. This is reality. This is a process, and racial relations are a process. And now we are at a juncture that's very important, because we need to speak out and speak up about what needs to be done. And this is what motivated the Brazilian civil society to respond. Every time it's called upon to say something, it says, not always is it possible for the civil society to give the right response or the right answer, because it's difficult for the society to have access to good information, especially racial information. But it's with a lot of skill, in a very emotional way, but also with a lot of reason and with great technical skills, that Brazilian civil society looks at all these race relations. And I would like to paraphrase or mention here another expression used by somebody else. Well, we came here from CERT to tie the ropes together. So with several short pieces of rope, we're going to tie them together because we want to be part of this. We want to be inside this movement here. We will be part of that. We want to be on board. We want to be part of what is going to be decided for Brazil. We will be part of the partnership with the U.S. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Malakias. We have a lot of rope, and we don't want to hang by it. We want to tie it together. We want to make sure that you, as the audience, have an opportunity to experience what our colleagues have shared with you today. And I'd like to open the floor for questions or comments, or unless the panelists have to, please.
I just wanted to add one thing about this whole process of voting. It's interesting. The African Americans, the overwhelming majority in this country, still live in the southern part of the United States. Overall, African Americans voted 96% for Barack Obama. In the southern United States, three of the states that have heavily African American populations, Alabama, the white population gave Obama 10% of the vote. Mississippi, the white population gave Obama 11% of the vote. Louisiana, the white population gave Obama 14% of the vote. Overall, he received 43% of the white vote and a majority of the Latino vote. But that 43% and the Latina vote and that 96% of the African-American vote is what made him president of the United States. So to the extent that we lose as African-American the protection of the Voting Rights Act, which protects us in those southern states, we undercut that 96% vote.
Good afternoon to all. I would like to congratulate all the Brazilian black women, Brazilian women who are here and work in sugar cane. And I would also like to congratulate all the black women in the United States to work in the cotton issue here. And, you know, we have to get to the third floor. We don't have an elevator. We don't have anything. But the black community is made of mountain climbers, so we can do it. And since how are we going to do this without being able to go on? There's legislation in Brazil since 2003, and other laws that include the history of Brazilian Indians. And public schools and other schools in Brazil do not implement this law. So the law exists, but it's not implemented. People don't want to teach the history of blacks in Brazil in schools. I mean, very well. We may have holiday for the founding fathers of Brazil, but nothing about the black leaders in Brazil. And we say that it was Princess Isabel who freed the slaves, but that's not enough. Sometimes they say that we're ignorant or that our cognitive capacity is very low. What I say is that we have to build. We have to have a structure to understand the citizenship. Barack Obama was elected because he's American, he's black. And Edson dos Santos is a minister here. And having a black minister in Brazil is a reason for pride. So we have to wear what we feel in our sleeve, so to speak. You're my brother.
Realize that I can't hear anything here.
I mean, that we're having technical problems with sound here. The interpreters cannot hear her. The microphone is not working in the booth. I mean, the prosecutor's office, we have to be black people in all instances of the government power in Brazil. I mean, this... My name is Lisa, and I'm from the state of Bahia.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am?
We need a microphone in the back there.
I have a question for Dr. Hunterson.
UDC, University District of Columbia.
The representative of UDC. To know, I just wanted to know, when you mentioned Hillary Clinton as the first woman who was chosen as candidate by the party.
Meu nome é Rosângela Malachi.
I am Rosângela Marques. I'm a representative of civil society at the University of Maryland. Professor, you mentioned Hillary Clinton as the first woman candidate to the presidency of the U.S. However, I've read that Angela Davis was the first woman candidate and a black woman to boot. I mean, nobody ever mentions her. What's the difference? Why? Can you talk about other women too? Please.
Thank you. That was a wonderful question. And let me clarify, because what I thought I said, what I meant to say, was that Hillary Clinton was the first woman to have a realistic chance of winning the party nomination, which is the Democratic Party nomination. Now, there are many parties in the United States in our political system. There are two dominant parties. One is Democratic, the other is Republican. And those are the two parties from which the president is elected, either Republican or Democratic. That has been the case now for many, many years. So Hillary Clinton was the first woman candidate to have a chance of winning a major party nomination, which meant that she had the first credible chance of being elected president of the United States. Now, the first woman, African-American woman, who ran for president as a Democratic candidate was Shirley Chisholm, the great Shirley Chisholm. Shirley Chisholm was an elected congresswoman from Brooklyn, New York. She was an extraordinary voice in the politics of this country, and greatly assisted in the development of civil society. Her trademark was that she was unbossed and unbought, and that meant that she was an independent voice for change. Angela Davis was certainly a candidate for president, and she should be recognized as having been an aggressive, active voice for social change in the United States. But her candidacy did not result in the likelihood that she would be elected president. And Hillary Clinton is the first woman to have that real chance. It turns out that in the course of the election, Hillary Clinton won 18 million votes. 18 million Americans voted for her, which tells you that her candidacy was genuine mainstream politics. Obama, of course, won the nomination, which meant he had more. But that is the power of coalition politics. It was based on the overwhelming support that he received from African Americans, but the other constituencies that my colleague Elaine Jones referred to were necessary to ensure that he would be elected. And so that is an important distinction.
Thank you. You're going to have to come forward if you have a question, please. This gentleman. Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Both of
yes.
Senor?
Yes, okay. Hello, my name is Antoine Morris. I'm from the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. Wade is my boss. I have one question for the Brazilian representatives here, and that is in the States, we have a history in which, as Lane Jones noted before, that sometimes when our rights are, when we win our rights, there's a certain pushback to take them away. We've seen this happen over the course of our history. Now, I am wondering if in Brazil there's any worry that, that if Lula doesn't win the next election or if he's not president after his term is done, that the gains that might have been inspired by Durban and other measures would be compromised, undermined, or taken away. And I just want to get your thoughts on that.
First of all, I must clarify that President Lula will not be reelected in 2002. He has served two terms already. So the question is very pertinent. It's an important question. So we have to be concerned with the continuity of the current policies, right? So we have two bills in Congress which try to change this government policy and to consolidate this policy as a full right of the black population in Brazil. One of the laws is the law about racial equality. It's a lei that first admits that there is inequality, and this law also reaffirms the rights of blacks in Brazil. It's a very comprehensive law that touches many, many aspects of life, health, housing, the rights of traditional communities, sports, education. It's a very general and comprehensive law that protects the rights of African Brazilians. And we hope that this bill will be voted in Congress before the end of the year. And there's another law, and somebody asked a question about that. It's a law about quotas. This law is now being examined by the Senate in Brazil. And this law will make quotas a mandatory issue for Brazilian population. Because of colleges or university autonomy, they have a certain system of quotas, but it depends on each university of what they decide. Our colleague here, Eliane, knows better, but I think that we have about 53, 59 universities that practice this, what we call positive discrimination, or what we call here in the United States, so what we're trying to do is consolidate forever the system of affirmative action for black students in these universities. I mean, that's been very controversial. A lot of resistance has been arising against this, and there are lots of questions about this. But it's essential not only to have these laws passed by our Congress, but it's also necessary to make permanent all this process, all the policies within the society in Brazil. So we said here that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And justice, too. The price of justice is also vigilance. Malakias has mentioned that. So the other leg of the whole stool is social organization and the mobilization of civil society must be important. The society must be totally, completely vigilant in order to guarantee those rights. Thank you. I'd like to add something to that. I'd like to just add the following. And now I'm not going to speak as a representative of my organization, the CEERT. No, I'm just a person who is a teacher, a scholar, and I study racial relations. I hope that there will be no setback. I hope that there will be no setback. Also because previous governments like Fernando Henrique Cardoso also have approved and signed international conventions and treaties that brought to the fore racial issues in Brazil, and treaties that allowed us to move forward with this racial issue and reach the point that we reach now. When Lula came to government, he was a member of a political party that has as an office for, or against, rather, racial discrimination. So the party itself is very interested in that. I'm not a member of the Workers' Party. That's Lula's party. Milton Santos is a great professor, and he was my professor. And he's from Bahia, from the state of Bahia. I forget to end. He was from the state of Bahia. It looks like that all the great Brazilians are from Bahia. A minister, that doesn't really cover you and me. But we're great. We're great, too. I mean, if we're great, I'm not even sure. Well, my professors always said that intellectual work must be totally devoid of any bias. So I have some pretensions of doing intellectual work here, so I try to stay away from party politics, okay? But it's true. It must recognize that the Workers' Party has accumulated a whole experience because part of the black movement has helped to build this Workers' Party. And therefore, the Workers' Party has an office in itself that deals with racial relations. So, I mean, I think it would be difficult to have a setback, but of course, it's not impossible. And I'm talking here as a member of civil society. I'm not speaking on behalf of my organization. The question is a difficult question here. It's a question that is a little bit of a trap, but my answer is a personal answer.
In the United States, the changing demographics of Afro-Latinos, Afro-Caribbeans, Africans coming into the United States, what type of coalition or conversation will be created? Because then that expands the population, right, of African descendants within the United States. And it seems to me that the same thing will be happening in Brazil as populations of Colombia, of Bolivia begin to move into Brazil as well. So how or what is the model for dealing with that?
That is a wonderful question. Do you want me to start, Elaine? Let me start, and then my colleague Elaine Jones can add to it. Again, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, the organization that I represent, is made up of 200 national organizations representing a broad variety of interests here in the United States. As you might imagine, various communities of color, whether they are African American, Latino, Asian American, Arab American. I mentioned my friend who has just left the meeting, Chad Smith of the Cherokee Nation. The Native American population in the United States, by the way, consists of over 500 sovereign tribes, each of which is recognized as a government unto itself by the United States of America, in addition to being American citizens, so they have dual citizenship. But my point is that we learn the experience of dealing with a variety of different communities over time. The Leadership Conference, when we have a board meeting, it's like a domestic version of the United Nations with, I must say, some of the same chaos that we've come to associate with the international body. But one of the things that we do in order to make and to address the question that you have posed about how we deal with broadening relationships is to remember a central point of organizing, which is if you want a friend, you must first be a friend. If you want a friend, you have to be a friend. And what that means is if you are seeking to advance your political interests, you must take into account the interests of those that you work with in forming strategies that allow you to advance common interests that you share, as well as to help support interests that you may not have realized. I believe, Senora, that I may have met you either in Santiago, Chile, for the Western Hemispheric Conference for Durban, the original Durban Conference. I thought I recognized you from that meeting. I mentioned that meeting because you may recall that in Santiago, Chile, where the Western Hemispheric Press Conference took place, there was the emergence of African descendant populations from countries throughout South America that, for purposes of world knowledge, are not perceived as having African descendant populations. African descendants in Chile, in Paraguay, in Uruguay, as well as Colombia and Honduras and Venezuela, as well as Brazil, were all in attendance at that conference. We saw the emergence of indigenous populations, the Mapuche Indians, for example, who had the demonstration against in Chile that caused such a ruckus with the newly elected president, President Lagos, of Chile. All of that reflects the kind of turmoil that we have, not just in the United States, but that diversity can pose worldwide. But let me mention one thing. We have done something in the United States that I'm very proud of. We have taken a very diverse population, and we have forged a national unity around common values of equality, not always accurately applied, but at least in principle, it has been an organizing vehicle to group these organizations together. In other parts of the world right now, diversity poses the greatest challenge to internal national security, whether it is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which has been the subject of much discussion, whether it is in Rwanda, the Tutsi and Hutu, whether it is in Northern Ireland between the Catholics and the Protestants, whether it is in the former Yugoslavia with the Bosnians, the Serbs, and the Croats. We have taken that kind of diversity and avoided the internal conflict that frequently appears in other parts of the world. But that is not to say that we have mastered the system. What it is to say is that we are beginning a process of self-awareness of how you deal with diverse populations around common principles of equality. Elaine?
What I think we have learned here is if you can make that diversity work for you as opposed to working against you, you can really make a difference and everybody can move. It's an educational process. You know, when the Legal Defense Fund first got started, I remember I was told about it in the late 60s, but I do remember in the early 70s. I remember there was no legal civil rights organization for Latinos, no national civil rights. And yet, when we were in court, we needed a sister organization representing the interests of the Latina community so we would not be making arguments that would hurt them. And we needed enlightenment. And so the Legal Defense Fund went to the Ford Foundation and got $100,000. And with that money, we gave it to there was a Latina lawyer on our staff. And they set up an organization called the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. And MALDEF, over the years, became an equal partner with us. And that's the strength of the leadership conference. When we are fashioning arguments, to be able to sit around a table and have different constituent groups say, well, I agree with that, but I disagree with a different aspect because it affects me in different ways, things we wouldn't think of. And it makes us fashion our arguments in a way that is more comprehensive and inclusive. And we also means that we aren't just lawyers with a client arguing in the court. There's a movement. There is strong grassroots support for the position you take. Now, I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do after that case this morning. But if it comes out and undercuts that Voting Rights Act, that's not going to be the end of it.
Well, we are running up against a deadline for people to leave on a shuttle, but I would like to give the minister, if he would like, a last word, and our two other colleagues from Brazil some time. I know that you want to ask a quick question, or is it a comment? Un comentario o una pregunta?
Good evening. My name is George. I'm from Rio de Janeiro. I'm a young entrepreneur. We've been changing paradigms all over the world. We see it in several countries. In Brazil, after decades, we elected a president that came from the workers' class. In the U.S., you've elected a black man. On the one hand, you had Hillary with the support of women, and on the other hand, you had Obama. How do you see this struggle toward freedom, how they can work together and not pull on behalf of their side, because I'm a woman, I have all the women on my side, that kind of division?
Okay. Do you have one more question? Because we really are almost out of time. Do you want to ask?
Do you want to respond to this gentleman's question? Please. Uh-huh.
Good afternoon. I'm Cleide Crisargi. I'm a young entrepreneur. I represent Levantamos. I also represent Coletivo Nacional, Aponê. The network Sertão Brasil, Coletivo Blacktude, and a union of the heavy load workforce in the state of Bahia. One thing that I heard this morning, I'd like to make a comment rather than a question, it's related to the media. Things were said about the inclusion of young black people in the media. Unfortunately, though, our population is not integrated in this medium. When the government campaigns against dengue, we see it on TV. When we see campaigns against AIDS, it goes on TV. Why? Is it so difficult to see campaigns against racism on TV? One other thing. I'm here thanks to Levantamos, and I would like to thank Marcio and Simone for having given me this opportunity. The youth in Brazil, especially black youth, don't dream because we cannot dream. And through Levantamos, I'm able to dream. And I believe that here in the United States, from what we've seen these days, the public school student knows how to become an entrepreneur, learns how to become one. And this is a deficiency in our country. It's a minus in our country. And this is why our youth cannot dream and do not climb high enough. I would like our government to be aware of this so that we can multiply we are 10 youth that can multiply the situation in the state of Bahia, in the state of Rio? How can we make it so that our youth does not become marginalized, does not go into crime, but is able to think and dream as an entrepreneur? This depends on us. However, I would like to make a specific request to our government that it be attentive to that, that youth be given opportunities, that there be more exchanges, and that this network be broadened.
I don't think we're going to have time to answer all of that, but there is going to be time if someone would like to say something, and then we have coffee if you'd like to finish your discussion.
This young man posed a question which we have not had
I think we should try and answer it and let the minister Go ahead.
Your question about the divisions between the supporters of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama deserves a response. And yes, it is correct to assume that over time, Hillary Clinton had a broad support among women, and that, yes, Barack Obama had broad support among African Americans. But that was not quite as it came down. Let me say at the outset that when Hillary Clinton announced her campaign, she had far broader support in the African American community than did Barack Obama.
That's right.
And the truth is that she had earned it over time.
Yes.
She had been First Lady of the United States. She, of course, served during the term of her husband, Bill Clinton. And there had been a major set of initiatives that made her an attractive candidate for African Americans. When she announced her candidacy for president, it is fair to say that she had far broader support among African Americans than did Barack Obama. And I think there were two reasons. One, people believed that she had earned the right to be president because of her performance and her contributions to the country. And secondly, there was a belief among some in the African-American community that notwithstanding Obama's attractiveness, he could not win. He was too young and inexperienced at the time that he ran for president for many people to believe that he could win. And there was also a sense that he did not have the likelihood of support in the white community that would be necessary for him to win. Now, understand something. That reflects the kind of limiting blinders that racism will impose on one's expectations about the future. There were many in the African American community who did not believe, notwithstanding his qualifications, that enough white voters would support Barack Obama for him to be elected president. And it was only after he won the Iowa primary where it was demonstrated that white voters would support him. And it was only after Bill Clinton made errant comments about Obama's campaign that angered and alienated black voters that Obama began building enough support in the black community to be able to overcome those objectives. But last point, it would be a mistake to view those candidacies in polarized terms,
right,
in terms of women candidates and black candidates. You know, this country has a history of struggling with the issue of sexism and discrimination against women and discrimination against African Americans. You can go back to the time of the Civil War, where you had a group of women suffragettes trying to get achievement of equality for women, and those who supported Frederick Douglass, who wanted the rights given to African Americans, who had a similar tension. This tension has existed historically in America's search for democracy. But what is important is the aftermath of the election. Both Obama and Hillary recognized that it was in the interest of the country and in their own political interest to forge a relationship that enabled them to advance a broader cause. So for Obama to be elected president and for him to invite Hillary Clinton to become his Secretary of State was a recognition that merging the interests that both shared in common was better for the country as a whole and better for each of them as an individual candidate than the polarized struggle that your question would imply.
And two points on that. Obama would not have been elected had not those who supported Hillary in the primary supported him in a general election. It wouldn't have happened. The second thing is the importance in this election of youth. Youth of all races, of all colors. The youth were ahead of the rest of us. They got it. And the youth were telling their mothers and fathers and grandparents, what is wrong with you guys? You know, and so it was a movement. And Obama had the youth first. He had the youth first because they were organizing. And in the United States, this election was their movement. It was the movement that we had as youth in the 60s. And so we recognized that, and luckily, those of us who were older stopped and listened.
That's right. I think with those words, we can stop and listen and have our conversation over coffee. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you, Mr. Minister. Oh, one more word. I apologize. I was premature.
No, aqui tem, teve uma...
There was a question by Cleide from the state of Bahia. I'd like to answer her question. First of all, the anti-racism campaign. Yes, we have had institutional campaigns against racism and for racial equality. The discourse of the Brazilian government has it so that we have to have self-esteem on the part of black population. Therefore, we are working on the racial question only, mainly rather, on the positive side. In the context of the racial complexity that we have in our country, white, black, yellow, this is an aspect which we have been working on, but always investing on the positive side. As far as education is concerned, your comment is right. However, education should first and foremost prepare the child, the teenager, to make his or her option. Therefore, it has to be broad and show society as it is so that that person can make his or her choices. And we have to improve public education in Brazil. Our Ministry of Education has a program that measures primary education to identify its problems and improve its quality. And the government has also been investing in technical schooling. The Lula government administration will have left 234 technical schools built in the country in terms of training people, qualified people for the labor market. And I think that this will be quite significant. We are building more technical schools in this government than were made in previous governments. We are tripling the number of technical schools in Brazil today. And to conclude, the issue that Jorge has presented, we have to see this broadly. America is changing. It's not just Lula and Obama. We have President Lugo in Paraguay, who brought down historic dominating forces, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Chavez we had elections in El Salvador. And Rafael Correa in Ecuador. Countries like Brazil and the United States, which have a more structured economy, a better economic structure, we have to try and help articulate Latin America within a program of distribution of wealth, considering mainly those who have been excluded historically in all these countries. The election of both presidents, Lula and Obama, and the dialogue that has been opened between the USA and other countries in the Americas will allow us to have a new economic outlook and a social outlook in the Americas toward a common goal of growth and prosperity, things that were pushed aside, have been pushed aside for quite a long time. That's why, Jorge, I say that we need to have a broader vision, not only Brazil and the U.S. America has changed. It's important to be aware of this change in the American continent so that we are able to consolidate this change, as the question was put about where the policies which we have now will or will not be maintained. It will depend on our internal situation, but also on the international situation. If there is a cooperation, an exchange, a mutual strengthening relationship within our continent, the changes will be irreversible. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for an excellent panel. Thank you to everyone for coming.